Today's program is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working and event space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show tracing the stories behind your favorite Asian foods. I'm your host, Linda Liu. We are broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, we dig deep on a dish or aspect of Asian cuisine by having a conversation with a passionate people from the world of Asian food. Today, we're talking about Japanese-inspired bars and what Japanese-style bartending means in New York. Before this civilized drinking trend emerged, the 90s was dominated by glitzy and noisy Sex and the City-inspired cosmos and Wall Street martinis. In the mid-90s, we saw Angel Share open inside the East Village Izakaya Village Yokocho, which then inspired Sasha Petrosky's influential cocktail bar, Milk and Honey. Drawing from the precise culture, technique, and perfect execution of cocktails from Tokyo's high-end Ginza neighborhood, the city and the country's bar scene was revolutionized. We saw the rebirth of pre-prohibition bartending, and now, 20-odd years later, it looks like it's here to stay. Joining us in the studio, we have Karen Lin of Bar Moga and Leif Huckman of Hidden Pearl. With their help, we're going to dive into craft cocktail culture, the various points of Japanese influence at their bars, and what happens when you cross-pollinate that with the hustle and bustle of New York City. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so first, a little about our guests before we jump in. Karen Lin is the executive general manager of Bar Moga and Sakamai. Born in Taiwan, then raised in Japan and California, Karen graduated from USC's School of Pharmacy and worked as a clinical pharmacist before making a bold transition into hospitality in 2007. Karen trained with Shingo Gokan of Angel Share, studied in a culinary program in Italy, managed Dieci and Bohemian before taking her current position. A lifelong student, always eager to learn more about Japanese hospitality, Karen recently became certified as a sake sommelier from the Sake Service Institute. And Leif Huckman. Leif spent a decade in the New York City beverage world, where he apprenticed with a number of bartenders directly trained by Sasha of Milk and Honey. He worked at the likes of The Tasting Room, Freeman's, Gold Bar, Socialista, Marlowe & Sons, before making the leap to pursue his own vision with Donna in South Williamsburg, Brooklyn in 2012, where he is the principal owner and operator. Donna has been awarded Best New Bar in New York by Paper Magazine and nominated for Best Cocktail Bar in New York by Time Out New York. In addition to Donna, Leaf is the creative director at Hidden Pearl in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. All right, Karen, let's start with you.
Sure.
Tell us how you made that bold career change.
It wasn't easy. I can say that first. It was a lot of years invested. Went to school forever.
You got a degree.
Doctorate degree, and then did a residency. I worked as a clinical pharmacist for a little over 5 years at the VA hospital in Manhattan. And I think it was just, you know, something was missing, and I felt it. You know, I think I ignored it in the beginning because I had a, you know, really stable job, and everything was good, but there's just something missing. And I think I was fortunate enough at the time I had people around me that supported, you know, what I wanted. But I think at the time I didn't even know really what I really, really wanted.
Yeah, how did you know? Was it like having that amazing cocktail?
You know, I think I was always interested in food and beverage and in an industry since I was young growing up in my family. I think we were always eating, drinking, you know, and that was always part of my life. And so I think I did go into a little bit of a depression, you know, towards the end of my pharmacy career. And I happened to be living with my sister at the time that, you know, noticed, and she, you know, she kind of nudged me a little bit, you know, if you're not happy, just, you know, find what you want to do. And she's always been involved in hospitality.
Ah.
So at the time she was just working at a neighborhood Irish bar in the East Village. And she said, you know what, why don't you just come and, you know,
like pick up a few shifts.
Just try it out. So what was first just a little break, you know, from pharmacy became something that I realized I loved. And I was just naturally, not just naturally drawn to hospitality, and but, you know, it was something that I felt like I could do, you know. And so I made that move. And again, it wasn't easy because I, you know, it was a steady, you know, job. And, you know, again, you know, I was that stereotypical, you know, Asian kid model, you know, that my parents, you know, it was hard for them to accept at first too.
Yeah. But look at you now.
Yeah. But, you know, it's something that I think, you know, at the end of the day, they're like, well, you need to do what you love. And I think we're, you know, lucky enough here that we get to do what we love.
Yeah, that's a really great story. It's so inspirational. And so beyond your sister, thank you, sister, who or what else were your major influences?
You know, again, I think I was very blessed to have connected with the right people. And
quite early on.
I have been surrounded by people who really love what they do. And, you know, I can't really pinpoint out exactly who, but I can say that, you know, from just being at that Irish bar, and then from there realizing that, all right, I need to expand my horizons. And my first job was at, like my first real job in the industry was as a bartender at Lawn Restaurant, which has already closed, but that was where I met Shingo. Mm. That was where I met our executive chef at Sakamai, Chef Akiyama. And it just, from there, it just kind of spiraled into...
So kind of the right warm hospitality community here in New York.
And very Japanese, actually. I somehow just fell into that.
Right.
I think I chose Lawn at the time, you know, again, growing up with Japanese food. And
do you speak Japanese?
I do. I sometimes hesitate because my Japanese is not very like formal like Japanese, and so I get kind of nervous when I have to speak it. But conversational, yes. Like it's
No, so that's already amazing for someone that speaks like English and I assume Chinese too.
Yeah, my Mandarin is it's also not very proud of it, but I can.
There you go. Trilingual, that's something.
Yeah, I have so many people to be thankful for. That have, you know, helped me get to where I am.
Cool. And I'm curious to hear, is there anything from pharmacy that you brought, you know, with you to the hospitality world?
That's a really interesting question. When I first started bartending, I was seeing some parallelisms. For example, no one ever sees your feet because you're just basically behind a counter.
Never thought about that.
People see you from the waist up, right? You're concocting something to help the other person feel better. All right, so, you know, at least in bartending, I also get to try it. And so, and even just like, you know, little things of like, you know, figuring out costs and, you know, how to like, you know, it's a little bit similar in running a pharmacy as well. So I guess you could say that.
Yeah, definitely parallels. That's cool. So could you tell us about the concept of Bar Moga? What's the vibe like there?
Yeah, so Bar Moga, Moga stands, is a short for modern girl. Phonetically in Japanese, it's Modangaru, so Moga. So that's, they just take the first two letters of the phrase. And this Moga was a term coined during the 1920s when westernization started in Japan. And so during the Taisho Showa era, there was a movement of women and men, but mostly I think the younger women who wanted to be independent, who wanted to show that they could be equals in a male-dominated society, and kind of also parallels with the like flapper movement in the U.S. And it was also during that time that I think you know, Western cocktails also came to Japan. So that's kind of why we went that direction. We wanted to create something that was Japanese, but then also Western. And we just felt, well, when did, you know, cocktails start in Japan? It was probably around that time that I think it started to pick up. And yeah, we picked Moga because it just felt that, you know, not a lot of people know about that time in Japan. There was a time where, you know, women wanted to stand up, you know, and yeah, we really wanted to embrace that idea and that concept.
Yeah.
There's not a bar like that, you know, in the city at the moment. So.
Right. And then the space, is that like reflective of that time period too?
Yeah, so a lot of our fixtures and just the style and what we're trying to do there, I think reflects the Moga movement, as you can say.
Cool. Yeah. Could you describe some of your signature drinks?
Sure. So we had several people help develop our cocktail program, and what we wanted to do was to find something, again, you know, to reflect the Moga period. We wanted something that was, you know, Japanese, but also Western influenced. So a lot of our cocktails have ingredients that have both Western and Japanese ingredients. So for example, we have a cocktail called Barley Two Ways. So it has scotch and mugi shochu. So it's like two, you know, very classic barley-based spirits, one from the West and one from Japan.
Yeah.
And a lot of our cocktails also have shochu in it. But not only that, like even, you know, citrus, I'm using, you know, kabosu, or using shijimi, and just using some very common ingredients that are used in Japan, but putting them into a cocktail. And although they might seem unfamiliar to people, I think that we're hoping that we're making it accessible to them by putting it in a cocktail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen the beautiful photos of your drinks as well. It looks really classic in Japanese, but the way you describe it sounds quite creative.
Yes. Yes.
The combination of those ingredients.
Yes. I think, we've been, you know, lucky to have people that have developed these cocktails that, yeah, they look Japanese, maybe taste kind of Western, maybe both. Yeah, so.
Okay, very Bar Moga. Very
yes.
Moga. And then I also heard about cocoa spirit at Bar Moga earlier this year on another Heritage radio show, Japan Eats. Could you tell us what that program is about?
Yes, very excited about this. We actually launched this program in May. And cocoa is a really wonderful young woman. Her name is Kayoko Seo, which she goes by Coco. And I had the pleasure of meeting her when she actually worked at Angel Share back in the day, during the Shingo days, actually. So, and she is very passionate about Japanese spirits, Japanese whiskey, shochu. And, you know, we talked one day, and you know, I just felt that she is like the real life Moga. She is Moga. And if you ever meet her and you come on a Wednesday, which is when we do Cocoa Spirit, you'll see her and you'll, oh, that's a Moga. She is.
Living and, embodiment.
And yes, she is. And she, and it's just a very casual, set up like a happy hour event where she will feature a Japanese spirit. So, you know, we've done Ichigo, you know, one of the most popular shochu brands in Japan. We've done Toki Suntory Whiskey. We've done, Akamao, which is another, it's like imo, like a sweet potato shochu. And right now we're doing Midori, which is, which is interesting
because
I think people forgot about that for a while.
Muskmelon.
Yes, it's a muskmelon liqueur. And it was developed in Japan. And interestingly, it was actually launched in New York City for the U.S. launch. It was in New York City in the 1970s. So,
and kind of retro. Trending.
Yeah, it's retro. And then we felt that it matched our concept as well. There's this, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but in Japan, especially during the Showa period, in those Yoshoku cafes, they have this like melon cream soda, just like this green, it looks so artificial. It's like this green thing and there's like a big thing of ice cream on top. So we're offering that and in addition to other, you know, Midori cocktails, but that's this month, so...
That's really fun. So having kind of a educational focus at the bar too.
Mm-hmm. And Coco is so great. She is very interactive with the guests, very approachable. And again, you can feel her passion and she wants to talk about it. And I think this is such a great program to have to let people know that they don't have to be scared about something that you don't know about and just come on out and have fun.
Yeah. So Wednesday nights?
Wednesday nights from 5 to 8.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. So Leaf, really interested in hearing more about how you ended up in your role as creative director at Hidden Pearl.
Yeah, I get to do the underachiever version of what Karen brought to the table. I do not have a PhD. I just want to make that clear at the offset. I went to school for theater and was a musician, am a musician, was a touring musician. And
oh, wow. No, so you've had a total like career kind of path before this,
true,
too.
True, wow. Yeah. And I was working in bars and restaurants to pay my rent initially. Mm-hmm. But I came into the restaurant scene in New York at a really unique time where the craft cocktail movement was having this huge rebirth. And I think happened upon working with really great people and at really great spaces that were inspiring to me. So initially, like Freeman's always comes up for me as being the light bulb moment where I remember very vividly walking into that space for the first time and you're walking down this alleyway.
Yeah.
You have no idea where you're going. There's this glowing light at the end. You open the door and you're like in the most amazing scene of people. And I was like, oh my God, I want to work here. And I turned the corner and I ran into a college friend and he was working. And
oh, wow. Very serendipitous.
Yeah. I was like, can I get a job here? So, eventually I was able to get a serving job in, I think, a bar tending shift on brunch. You know, I was willing to take whatever I could get. And the crew at the time was an incredible collection of people who now have really incredible careers like Jimmy Kearns, Lynette Marrero, Yana Wolfson, Toby Maloney, who opened up Violet Hour, Gregory Ramirez, just an incredible collection of people who have gone on to do wonderful things in our industry. And they were very warm and accommodating to me and were willing to show me the ropes. And I had worked in high volume bars up to that point, but I still didn't know how to make a drink to save my life, really. I didn't really know what went into a drink. And truthfully, I probably couldn't tell you what a craft cocktail was. Or I'm sorry, like how to define a cocktail, and it occurred to me this is kind of simultaneously with the growth of the slow food movement in New York,
and how like you define a cocktail then was changing too. That was like the inflection point, right? You were saying.
Yeah, I think that at that point you might define a cocktail as just something that was not just spirit, you know, something that was like spirit plus. And the way that I would define a cocktail now is different than that. You know, I think of a cocktail as being this axis between spirit and water and bitter and sweet. And that's something that I think even has a kind of a historical prevalence, you know, like this is a this is the way we approach creating a well-balanced cocktail, which is a term that you hear a lot in the cocktail world.
Yeah, and when I hear the phrase cocktail, I think of the full ambiance, the experience, mm-hmm. too.
Sure, and I think that was what was actually predominantly inspiring to me at the time. Freeman's, people would walk out of that restaurant saying that that was the best meal of their life. And the food was good, don't get me wrong, but I was like, best meal of your life? And I recognized that it was, people were not just eating their food and drinking their beverage, they were really taking in the entire experience. Mm-hmm. And that is, to me, the light bulb. And maybe that connected to my theatrical background, like where I was like, mm-hmm. oh, you're like setting a scene. Mm-hmm. And it's every point of the service and the experience that is going into what they're tasting.
Yeah.
Not just what they're feeling, but what they're tasting. And so that was really interesting to me. And spaces that continued to, or I guess, come onto my radar or be a part of my world, like Marlowe & Sons, which I also worked at, and Five Leaves, which I also worked at. There was this, to me, there was an even aesthetic quality that was shared amongst these spaces. What I've referred to as like a dilapidated elegance. They all looked like spaces that had once been very opulent and had mm-hmm. deteriorated over time.
But lived in.
Lived in. And that yeah. was important because we were, me and my friends were, you know, people who were playing in bands and, you know, we were wearing jeans and a t-shirt as I am here, you know, and like, I had grown out of wanting to go to a dive bar, but I didn't want to be in a fine dining environment. I didn't want that level of formality. So where was the in-between? Where was the space for me where I started to care about what went into my body? And that was, I think, what I was trying to say before. Like with slow food, we were becoming more conscientious of seasonality and locality in our food. We weren't asking questions about what we were drinking, and we were drinking all the time. So the craft cocktail movement to me was almost this like connection to slow food, which is like, well, what is in your bourbon? What is Maker's Mark made out of? And what is bourbon versus rye? Why is scotch scotch? You know, and all of these questions became this huge explosion of like, oh my God, like this is something that I do all the time. And yet I have not put any care into thinking about what I'm consuming. So the craft cocktail movement, I happened to fall into, I think, at the right place and right time, and had people who were willing to take me along that journey. And I'm still learning all the time. I mean, this program in particular at the Hidden Pearl, learning about shochu has been like the most interesting category of spirit for me most recently. Yeah. And I knew nothing of it. You know, I couldn't have told you what shochu was. I couldn't have defined that for you. And I didn't really know that there was a difference between shochu and soju, you mm-hmm. know, and I do now, which is...
yeah, so Hidden Pearl, could you tell us about the concept behind Hidden Pearl?
Yeah, Hidden Pearl was, I think, a very organic collaboration between the restaurant group that owns that space and one of their investors who happened to be a neighbor to Donna and invited us to tour the space and maybe talk about doing a cocktail program. When I walked into the space, the way that they had designed it, it's basically like a long rectangle, but they had created a bifurcated space because the kitchen was kind of in the middle interior and the bathrooms were adjacent to the kitchen. So there was like a room, a hallway, and a room. And the room in the back, when I walked into it, had this beautiful skylight and was filled with natural light. And I was like, this is so cool. Like, we should do more than just a cocktail program. We should, like, create an experience back here. And it's already separated such that that would make a lot of sense and that can be a lot of fun. And so I pitched them on this idea. And really, the vision for the whole thing came to me in one fell swoop where I was, you know, I was like, you know, it's like, it's going to be this, like, you know, maybe 18, 20 seats, this sort of secret bar experience, this like hidden jewel, and it's like a hidden pearl, and you know, it was just like very stream of consciousness, but mm-hmm. but it tied it all together for me, where knowing that we were going to be connected to the ramen restaurant Wanpaku, which is in front, and a Japanese kitchen to serve Japanese food and beverage, a Japanese inspired beverage program in this speakeasy style bar that played against your expectations of a speakeasy in ways that I really enjoy. Because a speakeasy can be like a very kind of dark, dungeony space, or that's kind of what my mind conjures when I think of a speakeasy. And The hidden pearl is not that. The hidden mm-hmm. pearl is you
it's
walk.
It's full of light.
It's full of light and full of like, just plants and space. And I think it's a fun experience to watch people walk through that door for the first time. And that's what we wanted to achieve there.
Oh, again, setting the stage. Very fun.
Setting the stage, yeah.
So could you also describe some of your signature drinks?
Yeah, I think the most signature is probably the Karayushi Club cocktail. And the Karayushi Club cocktail is essentially, it's like a tiki-fied riff with passion fruit and with Toki Japanese whiskey taking the lead role. And it's fun to play with that cocktail because it's served over crushed ice, has this beautiful electric orange color and an edible orchid garnish. But it's made with Japanese whiskey. And obviously Toki's a lighter style of whiskey, so it's much more malleable. But it's still whiskey, and I don't think you would take a sip of that drink and imagine that the base spirit is a whiskey there. And so I really enjoy having people try that and then play that against one of our classic highballs, which is the Colorless Sakuru. And the Colorless Sakuru is essentially just an improved whiskey soda, which is your most classic Japanese highball, where we're using a coconut celery bitters on top of that.
Amazing.
Cool. Yeah.
It's because really good right now.
As she was saying with like the barley two ways, you know, this is Japanese whiskey two ways. You know, you can get in this very dry, austere style.
Yeah.
Or you can get in this like very fruity, funky style. And I think also with the Hidden Pearl, and I'm sure you're going to get to this as well, but like where we were thinking of the Japanese bar as an inspirational point, it was actually very intimidating to us because it's a serious tradition. And what's I think amazing about Japanese bars, especially in New York, is that we think of the Japanese bar style as being this unbroken chain because Japan never went through prohibition. So once the cocktail was introduced to Japan, there was never a moment in time that they stopped doing it that way.
Yeah, they just kept going.
They just kept going. And so it's like a time capsule. And that was what was initially very inspirational to Sasha and many of those who came alongside him or after him. We do not come from that tradition. We did not want to, appropriate anything that we didn't feel like we could inhabit fully. But then I thought about Donna, too. And although I'm of Latin heritage, and that was kind of the inspirational point for Donna, being that my mother is from Honduras, and we wanted to evoke Central America in the design and in the beverage program. Donna's not a Latin American bar, and I wouldn't describe it as such, you know. And so similarly, I think the Hidden Pearl is very inspired by Japan, but I don't think of it as a Japanese bar. You know, I think of it as a cocktail bar.
Yeah. Hold that thought. We're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
One Hundred Bogart has made much progress over the past year since their grand opening. They are a growing community of professional freelancers, entrepreneurs, and startups. Their dedicated team guarantees you receive a productive and worry-free work environment. 100 Bogart is currently filling up their 2-person to 12-person private offices. The spacious pop-up gallery, premier rooftop, and brand new full floor with terrace are available for your next event. Podcast rooms, conference rooms, and meeting spaces are also available for booking. 100 Bogart hosts events like art exhibitions, pop-up stores, product launches, and fashion shows. Heritage Radio Network is a proud member of the 100 Bogart community and often holds events in the building. Visit 100bogart.com to schedule a tour and learn more.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West, and we're talking about aspects of Japanese culture and how the Japanese beverage culture has influenced your bars. So Lee, if you were talking about some of those influences at Hidden Pearl, also curious, there is a tropical slant to...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so what's that about?
I think that's really about bringing the spirit of Donna into a smaller space. And so, you know, Donna is... We're also influenced by tiki culture, but we never refer to ourselves as a tiki bar. So I think we've often said that we're tropical, not tiki. And wanting to find a way to... It was almost like in a Venn diagram. We're like, okay, like... tropical Japan, and then in researching tropical Japan, that's where a lot of our inspiration came from, and we really kind of fell upon Okinawa as an inspirational point, thinking of tropical Japan and like what was coming up when we were searching for that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Karen, you're familiar with Okinawa, totally,
yeah,
right?
Well, what's interesting is Moga just recently, we have a secret tiki menu right now.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, which is, you know, has awamori and like, you know, we're like trying to like play with that.
Amazing, yeah.
And, you know, some people are like, wait, you're a Japanese themed bar. Like, how does tiki play a role in this? And I was like, well, okay, did everyone forget about Okinawa?
Right.
Like, that's where it's from. So
that's where it's at.
Yeah, they have a lot of interesting ingredients. Mm-hmm. And their food culture, their beverage culture is so different from the main part of Japan. So I think it's an unearthed, you know, thing for people to discover. It's so much fun. Yeah.
Even I had mentioned the Karayushi Club cocktail at the Hidden Pearl before. Mm-hmm. Like the Karayushi Club is the very first political party of Okinawa.
Oh.
And it was named after the Karayushi the shirt, which is very similar to a Hawaiian shirt. It's like a floral print shirt that is common to the island.
Got it. Yeah, I always find cocktail names to be so unique and fun. And clearly you guys have given this a ton of thought.
Yeah.
I think you have to. I mean, you know, we're living in one of the most competitive food and beverage, you know, scenes in the world, really. And that's what makes it fun. But it is also a community, and that's why it's so supportive and connected.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
What other aspects of Japanese influence do you guys have at your bar? I'm thinking about things like, so we talked about some of the ingredients that you guys use in the cocktail recipes, but also there seems to be a distinct attention to detail and amazing service.
Yeah, I think those are things are very Japanese, I guess you could say.
Karen might agree with me too, but I think those are particular to the cocktail bar, like as we would define it in you know, modern terms. Like, I think those two things happen to just be very connected.
Related, and I think beverage and, you know, food too, I think is very service, attention to detail, precision, you
ritual.
Know, ritual. Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
That was definitely an aspect of in investigating, like, what is a Japanese bar for, to begin with, finding ritual in Japanese service in general, and seeing how that has influenced Japanese bar service, and finding ways to allow that to inspire us, you know, and I think that it does. There's a lot of corollaries to what we already do in the cocktail world, but having a raised consciousness of that is useful.
The double whammy.
Yeah. And it reminds me of learning about that in Japanese cocktail service, actually being very quiet was important. And we didn't have any implications of putting that into our own service until we were in our 18-seat room playing vinyl records only. Mm-hmm. And when the record stops and you're like making your drinks, and if you're making a whole bunch of noise, it's just not very pleasant. So all of a sudden there was this attention to the noise that you were making, and it wasn't an intentional, like, okay, we're going to do this in this particular style and, you know, be very quiet. It was just like a result of the room. And in, but knowing that about the Japanese bar style,
I think you're like being mindful of it, and it just happened organically.
That's
because
of
the space, and I think you just already had an intention of what you wanted it to be too.
Right.
So I think it just naturally went that way, and I think a lot, you know, for the guests, you know, they might not know that this is what's happening in your head, or but they might feel like, oh, it's so reminiscent of a Japanese bar, but why?
Right.
Yeah.
But it's because of that. But
those
little
details, that's the secret.
Yep.
That's the secret ingredient for all of these spaces that I think we go to and love. It's like the little tiny details that take you the 15th time of going there. You're like,
absolutely.
Oh, I never noticed that one little thing.
Yeah.
Wow. It's so exciting to know that, like, human thought went into every little aspect of a space.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as a customer, discovering all those little details, seeing your bartender also really take their time with crafting the cocktail, sometimes carving the ice even.
Yes, yes. Carving the ice is another ritualistic type of, like, absolutely. You know, before when I was at Bohemian, we used to have to use an ice pick to make spheres instead of using the sphere machine. Wow. So we would just pick at it until it became a perfect sphere. And
how long does that take?
Well, you know, in the beginning it took a while, and then, you know, you just get faster and faster at it. But then, of course, you get a table of six and all of them want one.
Oh, right.
And then, okay, here we go. You know? And you just go for it. But, you know, it's in times like that that you see the guest experience is, yeah, that's their experience. They're watching you, you know.
You're the show.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and they don't mind waiting another 5 minutes for their cocktail because they're part of the experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you created at the Hidden Pearl, where everything is part of the experience of having that cocktail.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so cool. I'm curious to also hear, what do you feel like the key differences are between, say, Japan cocktail culture and now New York cocktail culture? I mean, there's clearly so many similarities, and there's a point that's being made in terms of, like, service, care, attentiveness, technique. But are there still differences?
For Japan and
New York? Yeah.
Well, I don't know how you feel about this, but I think that it's starting to kind of merge. I think in the past, it was a very, you know, that's why we were so fascinated with Japanese bartending, because it was so different from what people were doing here. And then we started incorporating it. And now, you know, for me, I'm seeing a lot of Japanese trained bartenders here go back to Japan now and bring what they learned in New York and bring it to Japan now. So I don't know. I'm seeing this kind of a merge of
both. The cross-pollination.
Yeah, I think so.
I haven't been to Japan, so I can't speak to what the culture is there, but from what I know, I think there is something shared in that you have two very densely populated metropolitan cities, and that in that dense population, you have to, I think, to create a competitive edge in any bar restaurant space, it's best to specialize. And that's what I think is one of the things that, from my understanding of Japanese culture, bar culture, that these are hyper specialized spaces. So, like, even within the Japanese bar scene, it's like you go to that place to get their fill in the blank, you know, that's a place that makes the most incredible spheres of ice that you've ever seen, you know, and that's a place that makes the best highball, and that's a place that makes the best whiskey sour, whatever it might be. And I think that New York culture is moving further and further into that direction as well. New Yorkers don't want a Walmart. New Yorkers don't want a one-stop shop. Yeah. They want to go to the place that is the best for fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. And you might replicate that for every 5-block radius of New York City. So there might be the best pizza place within every 5 blocks. But that's how we dine. Yeah. That's how we drink.
I think that's what's unique about New York City, and what's fun for us as, you know, people who work on the other side,
right,
that, you know, I think our consumer base in New York City, they're always looking for something that's the best or that's new, or and they're open to something that's different.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, they're open. So, you know, we have so much, you know, have fun. We can have fun with
that's
it.
Right. Yeah.
So that creative edge, do you think that's what the Japanese bartenders are taking back to Japan?
I think so. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that, you know, when you talk about Japanese classic cocktails, I mean, they're basically just the classic cocktails.
Right.
You know, what's a Japanese cocktail?
Just done really well.
It's just done, a really well-done gin gimlet. Right. That's a classic cocktail in Japan. But I think what's happening now is they're really just, you know, I think being this cross-pollination thing going on with the bar culture is really expanding. I think
And I think where we've taken from the Japanese bar tradition is also to be intentional with, that you could be intentional with anything. So even a highball, which is a cocktail, it's generally a 2-ingredient cocktail, right?
Yeah.
One that most bartenders would have probably rolled their eyes at, like, well, whatever, that's not a cocktail, you know? Now it's like, oh no, well, you know, if you build it in a Japanese style, you're talking about, you know, what ingredient goes in first? What is the ratio of spirit to water, or dilute, you know, the diluting component, and how many times are you turning it? In what direction?
Yeah.
Clockwise
and
counterclockwise.
So much detail.
So detailed. And like, does it make for a better drink? I don't know. But I bet you're going to enjoy the one that is made more intentionally.
Is it better?
I don't know. I mean, you could probably measure, you know, and you can measure the ratio of dilution, but it's not about that. It's about the intention. It's about, that's what you drink. You're drinking the care that was put into the beverage. Whether one is actually any more measurably better than the other.
Yeah, that's so interesting, though, like with the highball, you know,
how
everyone is just paying so much attention how to make the perfect highball.
Mm-hmm.
It's just whiskey and soda, but how do we make it perfect?
You know, what's the PSI of your soda? You know, like... These are things that are talked about. Yeah. And look, I think from my perspective, I do notice a discerning, like a difference. Yeah. I'm like, that's better. Yeah. I like, you know, that PSI is awesome. I want a super tea.
Yeah, it's like really carbonated. Yeah. Like how do you, like the temperature of the whiskey and the soda should be this in order to make
this. How does
this,
it hit my tongue?
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think when you're in that mindset as a customer, you just feel everything, you know, the intention of the bartender, of the bar owner. That's really amazing. So it sounds like you guys are pro fusion, pro the cross-pollination of trends and learnings.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm pro-fusion, only because fusion means something. Fusion to me means like putting two things that are kind of like, it's almost like a juxtaposition. It's like this and that, you know, like I'm going to make like bacon kimchi pancakes, you know, or something like that, you know. And I don't think that that's what we're doing, at least at the Hidden Pearl. And from what I understand of what's going on at Bar Moga, like I think of cross-pollination is more accurate, you know, where...
Yeah, we should use that word more. Like, not fusion.
So on this show, actually this season, I'm trying to push fusion as a positive
word. Oh, interesting.
So having it turn from... maybe the kimchi bacon pancakes.
Yeah.
Although they do sound actually like this recipe I want to try.
Yeah, yeah. I would totally eat that.
That we can interpret, because that's like a really fast and easy word. Maybe we can switch it to have a positive intention.
Mm-hmm. I think when I hear fusion, like at first I just think of like there's, I've heard someone say, oh, fusion, confusion. It's just like, you don't even know what's happening there. And I'm like, well, I guess if you do to take two things, if it's not executed right, it is confused.
Yeah.
Like, what is it?
But what's the why? That's a big thing for me. It's like, why? Should they be fused? You know, like, why did you fuse them?
Yeah. I think if there's a thoughtful process behind it,
right.
I think fusion could be a positive. I think it's just maybe in the past, I don't know, decade or so, this word fusion just became...
I think in the 80s, whatever, that's when that... like negative connotation happened. But speaking of fusion / food, even with the Yokocho period, that type of cuisine was, you know, Japanese, but Japanese westernized.
Oh, for Yoshoku. Yoshoku. So that's a really interesting, you know, because I wouldn't really say it's fusion because it is Japanese food. Like Yoshoku is Japanese food, but it's Japanese food that became westernized during that period and just became like a, like, you know, it's home cooking. Actually.
Yeah, it's been in Japan since the 1920s.
Yes. Okay. That's when all the Western ingredients started coming in, like ketchup, curry, like, you know, and they were, they just started using it and they put it into their own, you know, way and made it into Japanese food.
Well, I mean, even the operators of Wanpaku, the restaurant that we're attached to, they had mentioned too that ramen, in fact, was a Chinese dish that was then imported to Japan. So we think of ramen as being uniquely Japanese, but when this kind of cross-pollination, this kind of like globalization of food, this is so old. You know, I mean, sugarcane isn't indigenous to the Caribbean, and yet that's where most of it is grown. You know, that came from the original European settlers to the Caribbean island from Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And so the history of food and how it has moved and traveled and what culture gets to take ownership of a particular...
That
is a very complex conversation, you know. Mm-hmm. An interesting one, but a complex one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can put labels against something, but they, number one, might not be accurate. Right. Number two, might not stick. Number three might change the next week.
That's right. And possibly it's our own biases towards like what we think of as something being, again, like I would, if somebody said like, where's ramen from? I'd say Japan.
Yeah. I'm thinking about like the 5 words I have to put in like a Google search, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh, my requirements are 140 characters. How am I going to explain this?
Right.
Yeah. So speaking of food, what are some of your signature dishes at Bar Moga?
So the yoshoku, So the yoshoku thought came after we first, you know, it was the concept of Moga and the bar and the cocktails. And then, well, what kind of food are we going to do with this? And we just thought about, well, what were they eating at the time? And it was yoshoku. And so, you know, I think one of the most popular one right now is our omurice. So the omelet over chicken fried rice, and we do it in a, they call it like the tampopo style, which is where it's a soft cooked omelet on top and you slit it with a, the chef comes out with a huge knife and like slits in the middle and it just kind of covers, you
know, it's made for social media.
It is made for social media. It is delicious, you know, mm-hmm. And but then you also have the mom's version of the omurice where they just wrap it, you know, in the like a crepe style omelet and wrap it, you know, inside with fried rice. Uh-huh. So that's yoshoku though. So that's we have that at Moga. We have, you know, croquettes. That's actually not Japanese, but they'll say it's mm-hmm. it's Japanese.
Totally. Yeah. Japanese yeah. style.
Japanese style croquette.
Yeah. And so what about at Hidden Pearl? What kind of food?
It's, and we describe it as Japanese tapas, which is a very fusion-y way of describing food to begin with.
Fusion-y.
Yeah. But so like one of the dishes that is very popular over there is crispy rice with spicy tuna. And so it's like sushi rice that's been shaped into a rectangle like you would on a piece of sushi. But then it's actually cooked in butter and fried, essentially. So it's super crispy. And then on top of that, the spicy tuna is placed with a little bit of dressing and then a slice of jalapeno. And it's awesome and flavorful and has incredible texture and juxtaposition of texture. And that's a huge favorite over there.
Awesome. So we talked about Japan's influence. Is there anywhere else in the world that's making waves in terms of trends or that folks in the beverage and hospitality industry are looking to for inspiration?
I have some ideas about that. I'm curious to hear what Karen has to say.
I'm kind of thinking about it. You know, I just keep going back to Japan a lot, you know, and only because
it's really top of mind.
It's just, you know, there's so much still that people haven't discovered yet.
And there's so many Japanese product coming to the market now too. Like this year, especially
new things. Exactly. Yeah.
Japanese whiskey is also having like a huge explosion in the market. I would say that I think the Caribbean is also actually quite has made a big impact this particular year. I think rum is having a big year. I think that the Haitian Claron is a hugely popular spirit of the moment, you know, and the minute it hit the market, it made a big splash. And Donna, I am proud to say, is one of the first bars that put it on
the menu.
Awesome!
I was like, you're putting on your Donna hat right now.
I know. But we also proudly serve it over at the Hidden Pearl as well. And what is cool about Claron and in terms of, I think why it's making such an impact is that Claron, similar to Mezcal, which had its moment, and it still is having its moment, but its moment started maybe a couple of years ago. It reflects a terroir. You're talking about single varietal sugarcane, single village distillation. It's a single distiller. It's like, you know, it's as farm to table as you can get in the beverage world, in the spirits world. And spontaneous fermentation, which I think is another really important part that you're not.
Well,
you're not purchasing yeast to affect a particular flavor profile. It's like that's the yeast that's in the air, man. Like that's what it tastes like is what's what we got.
Yeah, you're a wine drinker,
You'll totally get that verbiage, you know. And it is. It has as total corollaries to the natural wine world. So, in the spirits world, I have not, you know, had as much experience with spirits reflecting that kind of ethos. And I think what is even more interesting about Claron and Mezcal in terms of terroir, and maybe this is true for wine as well, but I think of it as there's a human history attached to it. You're talking about a distillation method that has generations upon generations. They've been doing it the same way. You're not just drinking like, oh, this is what the land tastes like. This is what the people taste like. This is their history. They've been making this spirit in this particular way for, we're talking hundreds of years. That is really interesting to me. There's a human element to that lineage that I find really fascinating.
Yeah, no, those are great answers, really cool. Great stories. Okay, so what are the goals for your respective bars in the next year?
Global domination.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I cut you off. Yeah, together, okay. Together.
Yeah, that's I think that's
okay, right. Sounds about right. Yeah, okay, yeah. We'll move on.
What else is there to say?
But also, what about you guys personally? Any other projects you're dipping your toes in?
Okay, I'll go first. Actually planning to open a kaiseki restaurant at the end of the year. And this is going to be so fun. I'm very excited about it. I'll be opening it with Chef Akiyama of Sakamaya Moga. Mm. And it's going to be a very small 14-seater. And, right now we don't have a hard liquor license, so I'm focusing on sake, wine, and beer.
Very cool.
Which is, already going to be a lot
Can you get any shochus in under that license?
I could.
You could, okay.
I just have to find, that's good, but still in the right alcohol range to get that. So, but, eventually I would love to have, whiskeys, for the restaurant. But yes, so, Chef Akiyama, he's a very talented chef. He's been in the industry for over 20 years, and most of that has been in New York. Mm-hmm. Although he is trained in Japan, went to culinary school in Japan, grew up in a sushi restaurant. Like, his parents owned a sushi place. So I feel like his food is basically a traditional kaiseki food, but through the eyes of a New York, like a Japanese New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's going to be, and very excited to make that happen. And so that's
awesome. Congratulations.
Up. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're working hard on it. So we're very excited.
What about you, Leaf?
I've had a pretty busy year between Donna and the Hidden Pearl.
Because Hidden Pearl is quite new, right?
It is. Yeah, it's 4.5 months old. So it's still a baby. And I have an actual real baby that's also 4.5 months old.
Oh, wow.
My son, Aaron Raphael.
The
parallel worlds, yeah. Yeah, I highly recommend opening a bar and having a baby at the same time. It's a really, I've done it twice now, and it's great. I've been doing a lot more consulting work, and so currently I'm working with a hotel in the Cayman Islands that I'll be visiting for the first time this weekend, which I'm excited about.
Oh, nice.
And these consulting things I'm doing in conjunction with Jeremy Ortel and Natasha David, who are my partners on these projects, including the Hidden Pearl. They really handle the creative side of drink development and staff training, and I just want to give them a shout out because I couldn't do what I do without them. And then we're working with a local restaurant group that is a very exciting partnership that I can't speak too much about, but they are expanding and opening up another space, and we're going to be working on that bar program with them. And as soon as it's announced, it's going to be a lot of fun, and I hope you guys join me there.
Yeah, so exciting.
Staying busy.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
Guys,
keep going.
All right. Before we end today's episode, we're going to shoot off some quick fire questions.
Mm.
They're all beverage related, so nothing to worry about. Just please share what comes to mind first.
Huh.
Okay. Number one, when you're out for dinner or drinks, what neighborhood do you end up in the most?
East Village.
Clinton Hill.
Other than your own bars, what's your favorite bar in New York City right now?
Dante.
So I kind of have an unorthodox answer here. Mm. So I actually like visiting an after-hour wine bar. That's in Midtown.
Is this a secret? Can you tell us?
No, it's not a super secret. It's called Kaoru is actually the name of the place, but during the day it's just like a Japanese kind of a piano bar. Mm-hmm. And then after midnight, one of a mutual friend runs a wine bar there, and it's from midnight to like whenever.
Oh, really, for industry folks,
it is.
Take us there.
It's a lot of fun, and it's always great to chat about wine with the people there.
Very cool.
How fun. Okay, what's a bar you haven't been to yet, but it's on your hit list?
Bar Moga now.
Well, the Hidden Pearl now.
Okay, all right. Well,
just for there. The record, too, I did try to go, but it was closed the day I went there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. We're closed too.
Was it Monday?
It probably was a Monday.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like learning. A one day I have off.
Yeah. Right. Well, we're open on Mondays now, so. Okay,
there you go. Yeah. Okay, the best drink you had recently, and it can be out, at your bar, at home. Was it the shot of vermouth you just took?
Actually, it's similar. What I've been making at home recently is Fino Sherry with Macvin de Jura.
What's that?
I'm glad you asked. Macvin de Jura is a... it is not a fortified wine, per se. It is grape juice that has been boiled to 50% volume, to which brandy is added. So it's similar to Pommeau, which is apple cider based, to which brandy is added. It's a juice that has been fortified with brandy. They are like, you know, wine-making grapes that go into it, but it comes out tasting very similar to a fortified wine, and that's it's like it's sweet, spicy. But so I've been essentially making like a bamboo riff, you know, where it's like kind of part fortified wine, part sherry.
Yum.
Oh, nice.
With orange bitters and a lemon twist.
That sounds delicious.
What are you going to call that?
I don't know. I'm going to call it the fusion.
Oh, all right. With sweet like intentions.
That's right.
I like that. Well, for cocktails, I think the most recent one I had that I was impressed with was back my old stomping grounds, Bohemian. The bartender made a tomato water cocktail, and it was just so good. And it was it was savory, it was light still, but it has some sweet notes. It was very balanced and wonderful. So that was my most recent, I think.
Oh, yeah. Wow. All right. Last question. What component, say like a spirit, a flavor, a garnish, or even the presentation, would you like to see more of in New York City being used in cocktails?
Well, in terms of, you mean like a particular
ingredient?
Yeah, ingredient.
Yeah, it can be anything. Anything that you want to have more of, more exposure.
I want to continue to see shochu utilized in more unique ways. Shochu is a really interesting category of spirit because I believe that there's about 48 different ingredients that shochu can technically be made of, although they're the three most prominent. But even within those three most prominent categories, rice, barley, sweet potato, the flavor profiles are like vastly
totally
different.
Yeah.
And then even the ABV levels are over the place. Anywhere from 20% all the way up to 40.
Like, how do you even graph this? 48, there's spectrums to each.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think you can. I think you just have to try. I mean, I also imagine that the segment of the shochu market that is not those primary three are not very good. You know, I think that most of them tend to be what they call like gift shop shochu.
So, I don't know if I'm familiar with that.
Like what you'd buy in the airport. Or something.
Okay. Yeah. Shochu is a challenge because I think again, like you said, because of the alcohol percentage is so different. Yeah. So you know, when you're making the cocktail, you know, you have to think about that too, and like which one do you use, and the different flavor profiles. Yeah, but it would be great to see people do that more. I think I also want to see people do sake cocktails more too. It's hard to find like a good sake cocktail. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people.
A good place to start too is the sakes that are already infused with flavor. So we've been playing with like umeshu and yuzushu.
Oh, yeah. Umeshu and yuzushu they're good ones.
They're
too.
Awesome. Yeah. They're so fun, and like that's a great way to utilize sake in a cocktail where you're getting a little something else.
Oh, amazing. So well, thank you for sharing your creative answers, guys.
Yeah.
And that wraps up our show. Thanks again. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We truly appreciate your support. If you're not following us on social, go check us out.
simply find us at Feast Meets West Eats on Instagram and search Feast Meets West on Facebook. And Karen Leaf, where should listeners go to follow you and keep up to date on all your many projects?
We're on Instagram, Facebook, barmoga.com. Yeah.
And yeah, we as well are on Facebook and Instagram, Hidden Pearl BK.
Awesome. And do you guys also have sites for your, groups, hospitality groups, creative?
Not at this time, no. So right now, my two, it would be following my bars, Donna mm-hmm. or the Hidden Pearl.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't really have one for the groups.
Not yet.
Follow us.
The groups are boring. It's like the bars are the fun stuff.
Sounds great. Feel free to reach out, leave a comment on a post, as we love hearing your feedback. And we'll be back in a couple weeks. That's October 31st with another awesome conversation from the world of Asian food.
Thank you, Linda.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.